Hello, folks. Welcome to this festive version of the Weekend Podcast. I'm joined by Hugo, and we're once again talking about The Great Reset, because not enough people are. We're going to be going through more of Klaus Schwab's book and exploring his thoughts on our inevitable dystopian future. Where are we going to begin?
Right, so we've got two segments prepared. The one for today is going to be The Return of Big Government, which is a section from Klaus Schwab's book, The Great Reset, well, COVID-19 and Great Reset. Some people have pointed out that Klaus Schwab is not the only author of the book. There's also another co-author, but Klaus Schwab is the one that's way more famous out of the two, so that's not really important. It's accurate enough to say that it's Klaus Schwab's book, sorry.
Well, I mean, he's been promoting this
constantly.
Yeah, yeah. He's the founder of the World Economic Forum. He seems to be the guy bringing all of these factors together.
And it's not like it's not like a report where 30 people put it together. It's the two of them and the other guy is not famous. So.
And he's been doing it for decades as well. So yeah, no, this is Klaus Schwab's brainchild.
Yeah, and so The Return of Big Government is going to be today's segments, and tomorrow's segments is going to be the Individual Reset, which is another section of his book. So tune in for that as well. And so the return of big government, that's the headline. And so
where did big government go?
Exactly. And that's what I'm saying at one point as well, because he says that in the post-Cold War decades in the Western world, the role of the state has shrunk considerably.
Just, what
planet is he living on? Like, this is not real. Like, is he a lizard?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on your perspective. If you want total government control and you're looking at it, oh, it's only 80% government control, then maybe you could say something like that.
But he's not just saying it's not large enough. He said it has shrunk.
Yeah, but that's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. I mean, I just can't believe that he can actually make that argument. Or make their claim. It's not an argument. Make their claim in his book with a straight face. Like, what's that about? And so he says that, quote, this is a situation that is set to change, as in the shrinking of the government, because it is hard to imagine how an exogenous shock of such magnitude and the one inflicted by COVID-19 could be addressed with purely market-based solutions. And so this is quite early into that his segment, and it's a weird framing, because of course the virus is real and the suffering that it has brought and destruction is real as well, and the effects on economies and on people it has are very real, but also states have made it into the catastrophe that it is. Like, the first China was cracking down on doctors and scientists. They were reporting on it and raising alarms of that is actually a problem and it needs to be dealt with by anyone. So they got thrown in jail, reportedly, or things like that, persecuted, killed. You can find that online. That's not a secret anymore. Yeah. And so then other states just reacted to it by mainly ignoring China, saying, like, okay, where does it come from? It's just came from space or something. And like, not at the beginning, they said something against China in the beginning, but they're not doing that anymore. Like, this is not, this is not something that's in the headline today.
No one's interested in holding China to account now.
And so what they did was to emulate China in the lockdowns that China instituted first. And that's what caused additional suffering, additional negative consequences. And there are, like, so many, just going through the document that we have that we're gonna, like, make into a bunch of articles at some point, consequences of COVID lockdowns is just horrific.
Yeah, the massive and unconstitutional overreach of governments as a result of essentially, and like you say, copying China is staggering. Yeah. Like, the idea that there's been some kind of reduction in government is just, I can't even imagine how he's saying this.
Yeah, he's saying that, like, since the Cold War and until COVID, so that's his. But since then,
he said Eastern Bloc.
Yes, but then the Eastern Bloc is also characterized by this kind of, like, steep and fast reduction of government powers and involvement in economies and societies at the end of the Cold War, right? And that produced some, like, many positive effects, some negative effects, in the sense that it produced kind of chaos and confusion at first. Like people didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of opportunities for like scams and yeah. things like that, just because of the nature of things being new and things being up in the air, right? And so that was a steep decrease. But since then, a lot of people have noticed and have documented that in all of the Eastern Bloc states, the power of the states has risen considerably just to keep up with the Western levels, right? So so that's another issue. But I can't imagine. It's just ridiculous that he's making that claim.
No, especially in the sort of English-speaking world, yeah. where we have had historically smaller states than we have now. I mean, it's...
Yeah, yeah. And so, actually, I want to come back to the start of his segment, because he starts with a quote, and he says, and he quotes someone else, and they say, "The COVID-19 pandemic has made governments important again. Not just powerful again, look at those once mighty companies begging for help, but also vital again. It matters enormously whether your country has a good health service, competent bureaucrats, and sound finances. Good government is the difference between living and dying." That's just, wow. I don't know where to start with this.
Without the government being good in Klaus Schwab's estimation, I'm going to die.
But also, look at what he did just in that small segment. Well, not him, the authors of the segment, who I don't know, but he quotes them. And so they say governments are bigger, they are more important, right? Mm-hmm. And then they switch to good government. Big government is not the same thing as good government, right?
If anything, you might be able to argue that it's the opposite of good government.
Yeah, you might, but even if you're not, like in political science, these things are very separate, and it has been studied thoroughly mm-hmm. what relationship between those actually is, and this is not the same thing. It's an entirely different concept. So for these people to make that kind of change, I assume that's not a mistake, but a grift. I just can't see it as anything else.
You know, I wouldn't actually ascribe malice here. I would actually be more inclined to ascribe incompetence and a kind of muddling philosophically of what they're doing here. Because we saw this with Klaus and his manifesto on the thing. The ability to distinguish what is and what should be was clearly just gone. And so to distinguish between big government and good government, maybe they are literally synonymous in their view. I mean, I did the book club yesterday with Tom Bingham's book on the rule of law, and he thought good government, the difference between good government and bad government, was the rule of law. And if there's one thing that we've seen violated with the COVID crisis, it's the rule of law. You know, governments are not simply allowed, at least traditionally in our constitutions and our history, to be able to tell you to close your business if you've done nothing wrong. And yet here we are. So,
they did it every time they needed to.
They did. But this is the point, isn't it? We're arguing about, you know, essentially definitions.
Yeah. yeah.
But I disagree with him that good government is big government.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
obviously, as you do.
Yeah, me too.
And but anyway, yes, okay.
Yeah, so Hanlon's razor is really, I shouldn't describe malice by incompetence, suffices.
But it does sound like a grift.
At the same time, what I tend to say as well is he wouldn't have gotten where he is if he was incompetent. Yeah. Like he's a very competent person, clearly. And those people who produce such an influential book that he quotes,
yeah.
same, right? So Hanlon's razor kind of, if you get to people on closer to the top of like societal hierarchies, whether just or unjust, like it breaks down a little. So that's just I don't know, I'm not sure obviously, but this is just very suspicious. So he says, during crises, governments grow. War against X is the rationale, and now it's just the war against the invisible enemy. Right?
Yeah.
So it's the same concept, same process. Wars cause states to raise money via taxes because people are scared, people allow them to do it, and then they can take those resources and fight the threat, whether it's real or yeah. supposed. And so he cites taxes going up as examples of that. What is interesting is what he actually chooses to cover and what he doesn't, right? And so it is obviously relevant for him to say, okay, taxes go up, and then just cite a few examples. But what he says is that the top income brackets in the US during World War II were 94%, and in the UK was 99.25%. And it's quite interesting because elsewhere in his book, he often argues against the US or against the UK or what they're doing, that he sees them as too individualistic, too capitalistic, too like classically liberal, I guess, yeah. whether justifiably or not. But he sees them as being wrong in doing things like that, as opposed to continental Europe, which he sees as better, more advanced, right? That's his kind of model. And yeah. so the fact that he also mentions France, but in the First World War, and so it's the most recent example, and the more recent example and the more extreme example, he lists the US and the UK, like mm-hmm. the hijackers. And so he's saying, look, they did it before, they can do it again, they can become like the continentals again, right? So that's what you see. No. If you read between the lines, if you read the entire book, that's the things that come up, that you can clearly see what his, you know, point of saying that, point of including this in the book, why he does that, right? Yeah, and so he says that okay, so like sometimes it's positive that the governments gain these powers during wars. He lists things such as the welfare state, right? Because so it's highly debatable whether welfare state is a positive thing, but he sees it as so, and so he talks about that.
I mean, just to be clear, I don't think the welfare state's been around long enough for us to be able to make a judgment, to be honest. I mean, it's been, what, four generations that the welfare state has been around for now? And, I mean, if we were... I don't know what metrics he's using to judge that it was a good thing, but, I mean, I think there's definitely an argument that it's been a bad thing.
Yeah.
At least for some people.
Yeah, it's been around for... there have been things that have been around for a way short amount of time that have been studied very well and that have been understood very mm-hmm. well. So the fact that this is a few generations, that's more than enough to like study this thing sure. and to like understand things about it, right? And it has been documented endlessly, like what the effects and the mm-hmm. positives and negatives of it are, so like people can find that out if they want. It's very well documented and a very well studied thing. And so yeah, he's being very one-sided here. And so he says, World War II, for example, led to the introduction of cradle-to-grave state welfare systems in most of Europe. That's true, but he's saying it as a positive thing, not as something that just changed and we have to figure out whether it's good or not, and we have to look out for something wrong that it might be doing.
Right? I mean, there's every chance that these cradle-to-grave welfare states will end up bankrupting the West and kind of ruining our economies.
Yeah.
Like this seems to be the direction it's going in. There's never going to be a time where the NHS requires less money.
Yep.
There's never going to be a time where we don't have mass immigration because we offer free money to unemployed people. Like these things... And the pensions are essentially a time bomb, and they know it. They know that there's going to be a collapse of pensions in the West at some point, as the longer-lived elderly people, who are the presumably parents of like one-child generations, single-child generations, realize that there's no one to pay for their pensions. So this is not sustainable.
And it's even less excusable if you take into account that there are systems at work today in the world that have addressed this and that have successfully managed to transfer from this, you know, I don't know what it's called really in English, but from the system where you pay taxes and these taxes directly go to the people that are old now, right? Mm-hmm. So these systems have transferred to, you know, the system where you actually invest in your own future, right? And in some ways it's still state managed, and so you don't have to do like a huge leap into something that you're completely unfamiliar with, but there are systems at work today which have addressed this and which have transferred to something else which seems to be working much better. Like so this is it's even less excusable if you take that into account. So it's just sad that this is the situation and that Klaus Schwab seems to be oblivious of this or malicious.
Let's be charitable and say oblivious.
Yeah, let's do that.
this incredibly credentialed professor, or like a PhD in mathematics and all of these others, he's incompetent and oblivious. He's not evil, honest.
So the next thing I wanted to mention is his framing of some things and what it says about the way he sees the world and that he sees the issues that he's looking at. And so he says that the coronavirus has revealed that social insurance is efficient and that offloading an even greater deal of responsibilities like health and education to individuals and the markets may not be in the best interest of society. And So, okay, we could talk about like state provided health and education, things like that. Okay, that's a huge discussion for somewhere else. That's not important here. But the important is the framing. He says offloading responsibilities from the state to the individuals.
That's really interesting, isn't it?
It is.
As if individuals actually don't bear responsibilities inherently.
Exactly.
Responsibility is naturally something that lies within the state. But I mean, I don't want to keep saying, well, it's the Germans, but that's a very German view of the state.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree with you with that assessment, but
it's true, that's why.
When I read it, it just screams at you, like this is the other way around.
My healthcare is my responsibility, and I should be the one who provides for it.
And just by the virtue of you being a person that controls your body, that controls your choices, right? And then someone else can do it for you if you allow them to or if you want them to, right? But it still comes from you because you're the individual, you control your own body, you own your own body. So this
fundamentally comes from the Enlightenment idea that sovereignty comes from the people.
But it's not just the physical body. You control that, right?
Yeah,
and so that's an extension of it.
Yeah, but it all comes from the idea of sort of natural rights, natural ability, self-ownership. Yeah,
that's right. It gets political then.
Yeah, and so when you start flipping and saying, well, actually, everything you have is given to you by the state and maybe the state will give some of it back to you if you're feeling lucky, you've got a kind of benevolent fascist view there. You know, it's like the state is, and that literally was the view of the fascists, that the people are the product of the state because the state is a kind of superior entity that exists through time and space and everyone is a product of the society over which the state governs. So, oh my God, this is a terrifying way to look at the world. You know, the sort of English-speaking world is the complete opposite, is the state is constructed by the people for their own needs rather than the other way around. But
and then he says just offloading. It can decide to offload some of its responsibilities to you.
Yeah.
But it can say, okay, that's not really in your interest, so we're not going to do it.
Or it can be so like, we don't care if it's not in your interest, here you go, we're going to make you do it.
No, but he's benevolent, he's considering whether it's in your interest
or not. Well, let's hope that someone not benevolent doesn't get control of his system, because then we're in real trouble, aren't we?
Exactly. Someone in the, like a very imperial costume or something.
It's mad. It's like the way he's looking at this is insane.
Yeah, yeah. And so then he goes on to quote other people. He brings other people into his book to like give him more credentials and then to make them more famous as well.
Yeah.
And so another quote that he has is by Mariana Mazzucato. And actually, I go back a little bit still, and so he starts saying, everything that comes in the post-pandemic era will lead us to rethink government's role. Rather than simply fixing market failures when they arise, they should, as suggested by the economist Mariana Mazzucato, move towards actively shaping and creating markets that deliver sustainable and inclusive growth.
Right, so command economy, that's what he wants.
Yeah, command economy for progressive goals, I'd say.
Well, that's literally been what every single socialist and communist regime has ever said about themselves.
Yes.
So, okay. I mean, does he ever call himself a communist or a socialist?
No.
It's weird because, I mean, he's just proposing it. He comes from the exact framework, the worldview that the socialists have, that the state actually, rights are constructed by the state. And he seems to be doing everything that they would want.
Never to my knowledge has he called himself a communist, but who is Mariana Mazzucato, right?
I bet she's a communist, isn't she?
She's actually the person who wrote the article with the headline "Avoiding a Climate Lockdown," right?
Right.
And so she's a UCL professor, right. University College London.
Yep.
She's the founder and director of the Institute for Innovation and Public Purpose at UCL.
Don't even know what to make of that. Okay.
She has masters in economics from the New School for Social Research, NSSR, right? And so what was that, right? So just on Wikipedia, in plain view, it says she was interested in exploring heterodox economics. Okay. So might be good or bad.
Yeah.
In exploring heterodox economics seriously when pursuing her degree. And she was well-trained at the NSSR, as it is the, quote, home for generations of radical intellectuals.
Oh, brilliant.
Here we go.
Brilliant. Yeah, exactly. No, I know exactly what we're dealing with. It's the age-old problem of communists who think that they can just systematize the world's economy.
Yep. And so that's who Klaus Schwab quotes in his book, and he obviously knows about her way more than I do, because otherwise he would not be quoting her.
Honestly, given what they're proposing and the way that they're proposing, I'm genuinely surprised that they're not openly more Marxist and just say, you know, I'm surprised that
it's not that popular. Well, in the wider public, it's like popular with very specific people at very specific places, but you have to be a bit opaque about it.
I suppose that's true.
So then Schwab says what the governments have done and how they helped the situation over this crisis. So he says, I'm paraphrasing, in April, governments have passed stimulus programs worth several trillion dollars. They supported the basic needs of the poorest people. They preserved jobs whenever possible. They helped business to survive and things like that. And then I'm quoting directly, central banks decided to cut rates and committed to provide all the liquidity that was needed, while governments started to expand social welfare benefits, make direct cash transfers, cover wages, and suspend loan and mortgage payments, among other responses. Only governments had the power, capability, and reach to make such decisions, without which economic calamity and a complete social meltdown would have prevailed. So the way that he's framing this is just unreal, because this is just a glaring, the clearest possible example of the government breaking your legs and then offering you crutches to help you. Right? And so just all these things, all these economic measures to help that person and this person, it's just a consequence of the necessities created by the lockdowns, right? Of course, the virus itself will affect economic life somehow, and people would adjust their consumption and their patterns of behavior in the economy based on their fears and well-founded fears of the virus. But at the same time, this was not the case. This did not happen. And that was not the situation in which the government would need to come in and do these programs to help.
No.
The situation was that the government had instituted all these lockdowns that have destroyed everything. Just why are we even talking about it? This is ridiculous.
Well, and not just that as well. Earlier you mentioned how he was saying, oh, there couldn't be a free market solution to this. Like, well, why not? Why wouldn't these drug companies be rushing, assuming governments turned around and said, well, look, we don't have the constitutional authority to do anything here, obviously, to your businesses. We're just the regulators who make sure that your vaccines are fine. Why would the companies not be still like, well, hang on, we're desperate to produce a vaccine because then we can sell it to now billions of people who are going to feel that they're at risk of this virus? Like, the free market would still have a solution here.
Yeah, exactly. And also, it's important to mention that private doesn't equal free market, right? And so if you have the government doing something in conjunction with several companies that working on some plans, that doesn't mean something free market is happening, right? Free market means competition. It means pushing down prices, pushing out quality because of the competition and creative destruction, things like that, right? That's the kind of process that happens. Just because something is private or nominally private doesn't mean it's free market. That's just, and so he,
but just to,
he
just to th- clarify
those things
though,
he often gets kind of confused or just doesn't just acknowledge at all.
But I mean, in the defense of the coronavirus response from governments, it has actually been a free market, hasn't it? There's been something like six different vaccines that are being developed.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So,
I didn't mean vaccine. You're right. Yeah. Yep.
But like, again, against Klaus Schwab's perspective, we actually have a free market response that we're all relying on right now. So I just don't agree with anything that he's proposing here.
Yeah. And I'm just imagining what it would be like if this vaccine process was not meddled with by governments at all. It's just like this is the, what governments do is just say, okay, we're gonna buy like billions of these vaccines and then we're gonna distribute how we want. Like, we,
why not sell them in shops?
But by now we would have like Amazon orders, right?
Yeah.
Like next door or something. Like, yeah. Not by now, but like I can assure you that it will be much faster than what the government is going to do over next year.
Yeah.
And it's going to be much fairer as well. Like, okay, some rich people are going to get it. Fine. Yeah. But then
they're going to get it anyway.
Yeah, exactly. That's not an issue. There's just like some people screeching in the corner. Like, that's going to happen. Like,
yeah.
one way or the other. The important thing is how the rest will play out, right? And governments don't know what's good for people on the ground. They know it much better themselves. And so you could have people ordering it for themselves and paying some money for themselves because they actually value the vaccine and having it themselves much more than someone else who's just living in the countryside and has no exposure or potential exposure to the virus at all.
Absolutely. And not just that, people with health issues, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Those elderly people will say, okay, well, I'll order myself a vaccine because I need it.
And
I'm not
and okay,
order,
okay
right?
If the government wants to just like do something, not just sit around, like it can give some money to those people with pre-existing conditions so they can buy it easier. There's plenty of other things that you can do other than just completely distort the market by just saying, okay, we're going to redistribute it differently. Just like,
when the government gets involved like that, you take out individual agency, you get the kind of stuff that was coming out of American universities where it was a manipulation of the data to try and make it look like, oh, actually, we need to avoid giving it to elderly white people and we need to start giving it to younger people of color to address historic injustices.
Exactly.
And that's wild.
Then you make all this political, right? In the same way that you're dealing with whether a Scotch egg is a suspension or not. Like, that's not a political issue. And this would not be an issue at all if the government didn't say you can only sell this under these circumstances. Like, this is just artificially created. This is not an issue.
Yeah. Never before have we had to discuss whether a Scotch egg is a substantial meal.
It's just so ridiculous.
Yeah.
So then just bring it to the end slowly. He says that how it will probably turn out, and he says it in an approving manner, that governments will, quote, decide that it's in the best interest of society to, quote, permanently increase their role. And so he said, yeah, governments will decide this, and so this is going to happen. Which
well, if
is
the
true.
Governments have decided it, then that's fine.
Which is true. That's what the governments will do, probably.
Yeah.
And that's what probably will happen. But why say it with approval, you know? Like,
because this is a moral justification.
Just because it happens doesn't mean it's good, Klaus. It's just like...
this is very much like a form of like preemptive rationalization of all of this being done.
Yeah.
Even though in any other time, in any other era, for any other reason, we'd call this fascism.
Not exactly. I mean, Klaus Schwab cites the 1930s. just below that, right?
Right.
Not in that sense. He says, when massive unemployment and economic insecurity were progressively addressed by a larger role for government in the 1930s, right? So that's...
In what country?
In the US. He means the US. Okay. The Great Depression, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is the picture that he's painting. Massive unemployment and economic insecurity were progressively addressed by a larger role for government. So he makes no mention of the Fed being created in 1913 and its policies during the 1920s actually creating the bubble causing the crash. And he also makes no reference to the fact that it was addressed in the way that it was by the New Deal and multiple other policies. The New Deal only came in 1933, and that caused the crisis to go on for more than a decade, right?
Yeah.
And so in comparison, you can actually see quite a close comparison, because there had been a depression in 1920, but no one knows about it because it went away because there was no large-scale policies and New Deal. And so that comparison is just like...
But again, it fits into his framework. He wants there to be a central bank that regulates all of the financial systems in the country and all the money supply and all the sort of stuff. And so within this framework, now he's in the framework, why would he go back and challenge that framework? This is the perfect framework for him. Because this is like Keynesianism on steroids, isn't it?
It is Keynesianism on steroids, but the central banks are not the product of Keynesianism. That didn't exist when the Fed was created. But the New Deal already is like that.
Keynesianism is probably a product of federal central banks.
I don't think so. But
I don't know. I don't think it can really exist without them, can it? So I think it's contingent on there being like this central bank to artificially manipulate the money supply.
It's an economic theory which explains how the economy operates, right? And so it says, okay, since the economy operates this way, there better be a central bank to do something about it to make it so that it actually works better, right? And so that would be a consequence of Keynesianism advocating for it. But central banks also came before that. There's a rich history of central banks before Keynesianism.
I agree.
So it's just it's an ex post facto justification for the central banks.
Yes, yeah. Yep. But I think it's a product of them as well. If you had a civilization that was prior to central banking, it's unlikely they'd come up with Keynesianism, right? They wouldn't be like, all right, we need quantitative easing now. That just wouldn't come into their minds because it wouldn't be something that was an option to do.
Yep.
So, but anyway, we're getting into the weeds now. So let's wrap
okay,
it up.
Okay, so let's wrap up. So all the way through, Schwab acts as if he thought that more state power, more state involvement is just great with no downside whatsoever. It's just, I don't know if he actually thinks that. It seems like he does, but
he seems to be quite consistent.
If he doesn't, he's like, why is he portraying himself? Does he know about it? Has he not had any feedback to his book when he like drafted it? Like, why is he? He's an economist. Like, even if he's a bad economist, he is aware of like the negative sides of state intervention in the economy and things like that, right? He's not oblivious to things like that. So why is he doing this? Like, I don't understand why he's just being so ridiculous about it. Yeah, and so then at the end, he just lists a million of social welfare state policies to grow and to kind of make stronger in the post-COVID world.
Oh, brilliant.
And so that's why I say it's just more of the same, right? The Great Reset is not actually something new, that it's the coming back to the factory setting after some kind of disruption, right? And so these problems that are created by these systems and by these
just political behaviors, you know?
Yeah, like, exactly. But so by these policies, these things will only intensify, because if you intensify those policies, the problems that they bring will intensify as well. So it's no Great Reset, it's just continuation, intensification of the status quo.
But the thing that you can tell is that it's all against the autonomy of the individual, mm-hmm. right? It's all against your particular ability to make individual choices and take individual actions. And you are supposed to defer your decision-making power to the state.
Yep.
And I think that's where we'll end the first half, because the next half we're going to be talking about the individual reset and how this ties together, which undoubtedly does. So we see you in that tomorrow.